Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this September 18th, Thursday. Our guest this hour has written an extremely interesting book on Iraq. He is the author of The Strongest Tribe, War, Politics, and the Endgame in Iraq. Bing West has written three books about the war. He was Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs under President Ronald Reagan. He served in Marine Infantry in Vietnam. He was an analyst at the RAND Corporation, where he wrote The Village, which is taught at the war colleges as a real basic understanding in counterinsurgency. As a correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly, he has covered the war for 6 years. His books on Iraq, No True Glory, a frontline account of the battle for Fallujah, and The March Up, Taking Baghdad with the United States Marines. He has won the Marine Corps Heritage Foundation's Award for Nonfiction. He has won the Colby Award for Military Nonfiction and the Veteran of Foreign Wars Media Award. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and his articles appear in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and other major newspapers. He appears on National Public Radio and the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. And the book, he says, has two parts. The early chapters of the book bring us through mid-2006, amidst the strategic mistakes and a growing frustration among the troops. And then he looks at what has happened since that time. Iraq was his second insurgency. As a grunt in Vietnam, he patrolled with a Marine squad and Vietnamese farmers in a combined action platoon in a remote village. And then later as a counterinsurgency analyst at the RAND Corporation, he visited Malaysia and Northern Ireland to look at British techniques and wrote a book about that. He's been embedded with over 60 American and Iraqi battalions in the course of hundreds of patrols and operations, has interviewed more than 2,000 soldiers, as well as generals and senior officials. And he is with us this hour of the program. We'll be welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Oh, I'm sorry, you should use the 800 number, but you can use the other one, but you're supposed to use the 800 number. I've done it for so many years, I forgot. And you can also send an email at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org, for you to join our conversation. Bing West, thank you so much for being with us this hour. Yeah, it's a pleasure. You start, and I'd like for you to talk more about him. You begin the book with a story about Captain Doug Zembiak. Is that how you pronounce his name? Why do you start with him and tell us his story?
Well, I start with Doug because inside the Army and the Marine Corps, Doug is a legend. I first knew him in the Battle of Fallujah, and he was a wonderful guy. He was an All-American wrestler at the Naval Academy. When I first met him, we were under fire on a rooftop, and he was talking about his dad. He was talking about his two children at the same time he was directing fire. And then he rushed downstairs and was yelling at the Marines to make sure they had put the china away in the house we were in so they wouldn't be hit by any stray bullets. And when it was time to eat, he made sure that the first rations went to the family of the house that were hiding on the first floor. So he had this ability to lead people, to be sympathetic with people, and yet to be a ferocious fighter in combat. And his troops just loved him, and they called him the Lion. And at the time, and that was in 2004, he was very skeptical about how we were really doing, and he had his company in the Fallujah fight. And I stayed with Doug several times over the years because he just had this warm, outgoing way about him. And then when I was to visit him in 2007, he was shot and killed in Baghdad. And he always was such a warrior and had such a reputation that the landing field that General Petraeus had in Baghdad was named the Zembiak landing zone. That's how many people he impressed inside the military. But nobody outside the military ever heard of him. So, you know, I was just so close to him that I thought the right way to start the book and to close the book was with Doug.
Yeah, it all comes down to the service of people, doesn't it? To the work that they are doing instead of these big shot generals, et cetera. These are the heroes.
Throughout the book, I try to explain that everyone was caught by surprise that this war turned around. We were losing in 2006, And now the war has left the front pages, et cetera. I mean, I was a little bit cynical about the New York Times saying Iraq has faded from the newspapers. Well, it's faded from the newspapers because the mainstream press really doesn't pay too much attention to it anymore because the fighting is basically over and the war turned around. So we criticized all the mistakes. But then, because of these young men on the ground, they were the ones who turned the war, not the generals and not the White House. All of a sudden, nobody reports on it anymore. And that's why I wrote my book, because I thought, that's really not fair. It's fair to criticize mistakes, but we should also give them credit for what they did.
You talk about what happened prior to 2006 and to the president rewarding loyalty above performance, the Presidential Medal of Freedom given to people who shouldn't have had it. Tommy Franks, Paul Bremer, George Tenet.
We're each entitled to our own opinions, but from what I saw, the people at the top made a lot of bad mistakes, and if you may make bad mistakes, you shouldn't be rewarded. I mean, I really worry about our country in certain ways. I mean, look at the financial meltdown that we're having,
mm-hmm.
and those CEOs walk out with tens of millions of dollars for
yeah.
being total screw-ups.
Right.
And that gets me angry, and then it also gets me angry to watch generals and ambassadors, whom everyone acknowledges they made terrible mistakes, and for some reason they're given the highest awards. That's wrong.
Mm-hmm. If indeed we are winning at this point, why don't we get out?
Well, we are. I mean, not everyone agrees. I mean, not only is the fighting war is over, but, and the reason it's over is because in the area where it was most fierce, Anbar province, where the Marines were west of Baghdad, beginning in 2006, the Sunnis said, we're on the wrong side. The Americans one day are going to leave, and we're going to be left with al-Qaeda. And the Sunnis flipped, swapped sides. So the fighting has come to such an end that the Marines want to leave Iraq and go to Afghanistan where the fight is. And we are getting out. Some of the Marine battalions right now, as I speak, are withdrawing. This new general we have over there, Odiano, who just took over, he gets it. And what we're going to see over the next year, and you're not going to see much publicity about Iraq, is that gradually more and more of our troops just get out. No one wants to make it a front page issue because that upsets people. And then they begin to say, oh my goodness, the strongest tribe is leaving us. Maybe I better get set against that real enemy that I have or something. So you have to be... you have to be subtle about how you get out, but we're getting out.
Mm-hmm. We had a guest on yesterday, and I was hearing a report on NPR from the author I can't remember because he's a New York Times reporter who's also just written a book, who said that part of the reason that things are going well or better with the Sunnis, that we're kind of propping them up or paying them anywhere from $300 to $500 a month to not fight.
That has it exactly backwards. What happened was that the Sunnis, who don't have any money, that the Sunnis rebelled against al-Qaeda. Now, the Marines are as poor as church mice, really, and they squeeze the nickels off, the buffaloes off nickels. So out in Anbar province, where the Sunnis initially, the tribes, rebelled against al-Qaeda, the Marines never paid anybody. They just organized the tribes and brought the tribes over to their side. When General Petraeus came in 2007 and saw what the Marines had done, he said, you know, I can do that across Iraq. I can make this a national program. And so you had the Americans out there, and the Sunnis in the neighborhoods, especially around Baghdad, were mm-hmm. coming to them and talking with them every day. And Petraeus said, begin to organize them just like they did in Anbar. And then Petraeus said, and you know, we have some money. Let's not be cheap about this. These guys are risking their lives. Let's pay them each $300 a month. So the amount of money is very, very small. They didn't come over for the money. They came over first and foremost to protect their own neighborhoods.
You talk at the end of the book about, and I want you to elaborate on this in some detail. First, we're in Iraq, you say, for the sake of ourselves. How so?
Well, at this particular point, once, no matter how you how a war starts, and we as a country, not just the president, voted to get into this war. But once you're in a war, you're in a war as a nation. And Al-Qaeda was not there at the beginning of this war. But Al-Qaeda came in because they thought this was a great chance to take over a country and humiliate the United States of America. Al-Qaeda is our blood enemy. They are out to kill us.
Mm-hmm.
The result now in Iraq is that Al-Qaeda has been dealt a heavy blow because the same Sunnis that they claimed they were coming in to liberate now hate them and have driven them out. So that's in the best interest of the United States of America. That's not just an Iraqi thing. That hit against Al-Qaeda spreads across the Middle East because the Sunni tribes talk to one another across the border. And so that is to our best interest what has happened in driving out Al-Qaeda.
Secondly, you say reducing the U.S. force in Iraq can be done prudently. What do you recommend?
Well, I have no doubt that General Odierno has a plan. I have no doubt about that. And I saw glimmers of it when I was over there in August, and that is, for instance, the 101st Division is south of Baghdad. And I talked to the colonel there, a wonderful guy, Dominic Caracciolo. And what Caracciolo was doing was he had three battalions, and they had about 30 outposts. And so over the he's planning over the next 3 months to pull back from 30 to 20 to 10. So it's a thinning out. But when you look at it, he was looking to gradually just get his soldiers out a little bit at a time. And I think that's what you're going to see. You're going to see a thinning out, not just pulling the plug. And I believe that's going to happen regardless of who the president is. You know, presidents can have presidential candidates can have rhetoric, but once they become the president, then the rhetoric no longer counts, and they look carefully at the plans.
Tell me, because I hear conflicting things on this. If Iraq held together in the face of a total pullout, you write, it would resent America for having given up. We had a guest on yesterday, Fawaz Jirjis, I'm sure you're familiar with him, who said that if you look at the polls over the recent few months, 90% of Iraqis want us out of there now. How do you reconcile that?
You look at some of the results you get from American polls too, and you have to take polls, I think, with a certain grain of salt. The reason I'm chuckling is I have a favorite thing I like to do when I'm going around the neighborhoods, and I'll say to Iraqis love to talk. They'll come right up to you and talk by the hour. Many of them are unemployed. They don't have too much to do, and therefore gossip is everywhere, and they love to stand there and gossip with you.
Sure.
And so what I basically say, at some point in the conversation, I'll say, gee, it's too bad us foreigners, we're not practicing Muslims or anything. It's too bad that we're here in your country, and maybe we should be getting out. Yes, yes. And I said, there's a lot of sentiment to do that. Yes, yes. And I guess you'd agree with that. Yes, yes. Well, that's good because the platoon that's in your neighborhood is due to leave next week. No, not my platoon. The other platoons. It's equivalent to the American public relative to Congress. Congress has what? A 10% approval rating in the United States. 90% of America are, opposed to how Congress has done, except for their own congressmen. They reelect their own congressmen 95% of the time. So we are as capable as the Iraqis of carrying contradictory thoughts in our heads at the same time and accepting that there's a contradiction. It's always the other guy who's the problem. But don't fool with my congressman. Don't pull out my platoon.
How many trips have you made to Iraq? It's a number, hasn't it, of them?
I've about 16 trips. I've been there less than a couple of the generals, but I've been there, I guess, over 18 months. Been out with 60 or 70 units at least, many on the second and third tours. I can't go to any of the bases now or something without bumping into somebody who knew me at some particular point. It's a very small community of people in the Army and the Marine Corps, really, that keep rotating through. They're their own small tribes.
Somewhere I've read about you that you are almost as personally invested in the current conflict as you were in Vietnam, and this is your attempt to ensure that the end game in Iraq turns out better than the last war.
That's an interesting perspective. I hadn't heard that, but that's very interesting about how people would take Peng West. And there's probably some truth to that, and I suspect that that may be driving Senator McCain too. I mean, most of us who really fought in Vietnam were keenly disappointed in how things just kind of fell apart.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really affected us as a nation for quite some time. And I think this would be worse if it just became an absolute disaster. And then you'd wonder, why did we have a million soldiers and Marines out there doing it? And at this point, when we're no longer in combat, when it's way down and we're withdrawing, why would we throw the whole thing away? I don't believe we will. But, you know, whoever wrote that about me, they may have been onto something.
It'll make you think about it during the day, won't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Yeah. You've studied counterinsurgency. You've looked at other parts of the world to look at this. Did we not understand, did we not have a counterinsurgency strategy until Petraeus kind of outlined this and studied it and you outlined and studied it? Did the administration not know what that was all about, what the strategy was?
Our military as a whole, after Vietnam, said, well, if this is how Vietnam's end up, we're never again fighting a Vietnam. And they turned to the Soviet Union as being the big enemy at the time. And they said, gee, if the Soviet Union attacks in Western Europe, they have more troops than us, we have to have some way of beating them. And so the Marines and the Army focused all their attention on a big war, and they felt comfortable with that. So when we went into Desert Storm in 1990-91, we just swept right across the Iraqi army, if you remember, and drove them out of Kuwait within 4 days. Then they had a ticker tape parade in New York City, the first one since World War II. So now if you think of the military as an institution, they said, we fight a fast war against another enemy, and the nation loves us. That's the trifecta. You know, we got it all together. So what did they do when Iraq came and they were ordered to attack? They attacked from Kuwait and got to Baghdad in 17 days, the fastest 500-mile armored march in history. Then they overthrew Saddam, looking for the army to fight. The Iraqi army faded away. And now the American military said, okay, it's over. We've won. We should be getting our ticker tape parade. They had not been thinking in terms of staying there for a long time and fighting an insurgency, and neither had the White House.
Mm-hmm. What did you think, and what are the lasting effects of the Abu Ghraib prison torture scandal?
It was a terrible, terrible blow to our image and self-respect around the world, and we lost entire sight of any perspective. I mean, in the case of Abu Ghraib, you had a squad of incompetent jerks and thugs, several of whom went to jail for 4 to 8 years, but they did not torture people, they humiliated people. We took that incident because of the power of those photographs. And we put that out in such a way that we flagellated ourselves and the Senate, et cetera, and we blew it far beyond proportions and did ourselves great harm. It happened, but we had no way of keeping things in perspective. And I wrote in the book, at that point, the Secretary of Defense should have said, it happened on my watch, I'm ultimately responsible, I resign. And he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And it may have helped if he had resigned then, but it showed again the power of the digital photo. I mean, it was remarkable. During World War II, the American military hanged publicly over 140 American soldiers and airmen, etc., for different crimes, and made the unit stand at attention and watch the public hanging. Can you imagine? I mean, when you look at the degree of crime, et cetera. But none of those were ever shown on the front page of newspapers. Can you imagine if we hanged some Americans for crimes? So the entire mood of our country and what we accept of our troops and how we look at things has changed dramatically since World War II.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, Bing, and we'll take them in just one moment. Our guest this hour is Bing West. He is a Marine combat veteran, served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. His book, his latest book, is The Strongest Tribe, War, Politics, and the Endgame in Iraq. He served, this is the third book in his trilogy chronicling the war in Iraq. He's a correspondent for The Atlantic, and he is the author of the Vietnam counterinsurgency classic, The Village. We'll welcome phone calls for him and also take emails. His book is now number 12 on the New York Times bestseller list. Our number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, it's talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Bing West, our guest this hour. His book is The Strongest Tribe, War, Politics, and the Endgame in Iraq. And we go to phone calls now and start with Mike from Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning, Colonel. What an opportunity to be able to ask you some questions. I got three. Is Iran going to get the bomb, and how are we going to deal with that? And will the Israelis let them? What are we going to do with the Russians, and how do you perceive in the long term our dealing with the Russians and the Chinese? I'm sorry, those are... It'd probably take an hour to answer.
Yeah, those are good questions.
Iran. Let me start with Iran relative to Iraq and then go to the bomb. Iran, for the last 2 years, have been backing this fellow by the name of Sadr, this renegade preacher who had a group called the Mahdi Army Militia. And Sadr's synapses don't all close. And he's now hiding somewhere in Iran. He plays a lot of Atari games. He'll probably never come back to Iraq as a leader. But his Mahdi army was beaten in battle in April. And as a consequence, Iran right now is trying to figure out how it gets back into the game in Iraq, because it's antagonized many of the political parties in Iraq because it backed this guy, Sadr. And they're trying to figure out how they get influence. And they haven't come up with one single strategy yet toward Iraq. And I doubt if they will. There'll be this uneasy, yes, we agree, Iraq and Iran, that we're all Shiites. Yes, we go back and forth to our different religious sites, but we are different people. One of us is Persian, the other one is Arab. So Iran relative to Iraq, Iran, I think, has overplayed its hand and won't be able to totally dominate Iraq. The bomb, the atomic bomb, is a different issue. That's an issue of whether the European nations and Russia and China and the United States can really agree to put sanctions to stop something that all of them know isn't in their best interests. And this is going to be a real tough one for the next president. President Bush was able to avoid this because they're probably still, say, 4 years away from having a bomb. But the next president is going to have to determine, can he get this consensus to put enough pressure on them not to have it? And if he doesn't, then would Israel strike? And, I don't make any crystal ball, but Israel struck Iraq in about 1981 or 82 to stop their nuclear reactor, and then they struck Syria last year to stop their nuclear reactor. So Israel would see this as a mortal threat. So the chances of some sort of real flare-up about 3 or 4 years from now, I'd say those chances are at least 50-50. Dealing with Russia, Russia made a mistake in Georgia on the large geopolitical scale, because it indicated that Russia wants a sphere of influence and really doesn't really buy into democracy. At the same time, it also illustrated that because 40% of the natural gas heating for Europe comes out of the fields of the Ukraine and Russia. They also indicated that they have great leverage over Europe. And the question, the United States, in this case, I think President Bush has been doing the right thing. He's been saying, okay, the Europeans keep saying we have to be united, that we're cowboys, etc. This time, we're going to allow Europe to be in the lead, and let's see how they handle this. And concerning China, I think we're doing a pretty good job of balancing our relationship with China. China clearly is on the rise, and so far I think we've done a pretty skillful job of not having that relationship between them and us deteriorate to any sort of Cold War.
What do you think about Iraq allowing China in to do a whole lot of oil drilling? Didn't they sign in the last couple of days a huge contract with China?
Yes, they did, and in a lot of ways, I think that is to the good. If you can make Iraq more just another normal Middle Eastern country, if you excuse the oxymoron,
right?
So that we're just dealing with politics and dealing with people trying to get, you know, long term contracts for energy, et cetera. I think that's to the good because it indicates there's a degree of stability there. China begins to have a stake in the stability of Iraq for the future. Now, China, for its own sake, has been going around trying to enter into very long-term energy contracts. So this whole issue about energy is, again, one of these issues that is just going to be increasing under the next president's watch, not decreasing, because there'll be a higher and higher demand for a finite resource.
Thanks, Mike, for the call. We go next to Rick from Oshkosh. Hi, Rick.
Hello. Thank you very much. I would just want to make one quick point, two quick points. Thank you, sir, for your service to our country. I respect that very much. But I do want to ask you, the various reports that I've read say that we're paying, I was dismayed to hear you dismiss, we gave these people $300 a piece. Well, various reports I've read, we're giving 135 to 170,000 people $10 a day, which I'm simple in arithmetic, but that's close to $2 million every day that we're basically giving to Muqtada al-Sadr and his militia to further arm themselves, are we not?
Actually, two different things there, Rick. Yeah, let's go through the math for a minute. You're quite right. And I didn't mean to be flippant. I just meant that $300 a month for somebody to be working, if you're in the police or you're in the army in Iraq, you're paid over $1,000. So they're only getting one-third, and Iraq now has picked up the contract, by the way. Iraq now is paying this money, and it ends up being about $200 to $300 million a year. And our point, the American point, has been to the Iraqi government, now look, $200 or $300 million, and you have $79 billion, we're talking here less than one-half of 1%. And for that amount of money, you have 100,000 Sunnis protecting their own neighborhoods. They're not a threat to anybody. They're protecting their own neighborhoods. They're not getting paid as much as others. For gosh sakes, you shouldn't even view this as being generous. The Shiite government, Shiite-dominated government, should view this as being in your very best interests. So the money part I don't really see as being that big a deal because it isn't in terms of the overall budget. The real issue is, are the Shiites willing to make this kind of compromise with the Sunnis? And our military and our diplomats are very skittery about this one because we really don't know. We're now in a political engagement in Iraq, not a war. The two major issues now in Iraq are both politics. The first is holding provincial elections to get people into the National Assembly who are responsible to the citizens of different provinces. And the second is persuading Prime Minister Maliki that he must reach a reasonable compromise with the Sunnis. So we're not giving money to Sadr's militia. Sadr's militia was taxing the people. They were taxing them $7 a house and $14 a business. So this was a little mafia that was running around. Mm. So the Iraqi Shiites are glad that Sadr's Mahdi Army isn't there anymore. The issue is the Shiite government going to pay and be tolerant of these 100,000 Sunnis that are these neighborhood watches?
Well, that's a huge question, and let me explore that a little further with you. From what I've read and from the people we've had on the air, the idea of building a government of national unity is one hard thing to do. What is it that the United States can do to help in that regard? And from your many times in Iraq, do you see the Iraqi government making progress on that front, Bing?
They are making progress, but they make progress the way our Congress makes progress.
Mm.
You have to be an optimist to believe it's progress. They're fractious. And for 400 years, the minority Sunnis really treated the majority Shiites in a terrible manner. So now that the Shiites are the majority and they have the power, they, in essence, they're saying to us, and they're saying to us Americans, now look, you have your democracy, and it's taken you a long way to get there. We'll eventually get there, but not today, because we really don't like these guys. So it's almost like the Reconstruction period after 1865, from 1865 to 1878, and then beyond that. And it to me, this notion that there's going to be national unity, I think that's kumbaya. I think that the Sunnis are in for a tough time, but that's different than fighting. You see what I mean? You can have a lot of mean things, and they aren't going to share resources properly, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's all up to them. I don't see that as being an American issue. Once al-Qaeda is out of there and you have a stable country, even though you have violence, that should be the end of our mission. I don't believe in big nation building.
Let's give you an email. I also served in the Marine Corps, the listener says, and spent two tours in Iraq. Please ask your guest about the following point. He claims that the Iraqi people will resent us for leaving without finishing the job. Won't they resent us for destroying their country in an unjust war?
You know, it's very interesting that the person who sent it in said he served two tours in the Marines. I really, if he'd get on the line, we could talk about this, because I spent a lot of time with the Marines. The idea of destroying the country, I'd really like to explore, because that's pretty incendiary. I mean, the fact is that we're not fighting. We're not destroying the place. We're out there, and you can walk anywhere. The Marines in Anbar want to leave to go to Afghanistan because that's where the fight is. There's no fighting in Anbar. So I am very puzzled by the email from a Marine, because that's not the Marines in Anbar.
What about what we hear, and granted this is some time ago, but give me an update on what's happening with schools, Bing? What's happening with daily life for Iraqis, hospitals being open, lights being able to be turned on, et cetera? Have things gotten much better?
A very mixed picture. Much better. To begin with, we have a socialist kind of government that was always there. Under Saddam, the deal was, you pretend to work, and I'll pretend to pay you. And what Saddam did was he gave food to practically everybody. Everyone has a ration card. So each person receives large sacks of rice and grain, if you want them, and most people take them, every month. Then electricity is free when it's on. But anyone listening would realize, well, wait a minute, are you telling me that I can turn on every appliance anytime I want and you don't have to pay for it? And the answer is yes. And then you'd say, well, then the grid has to be overloaded all the time. And the answer is yes. So then you say, well, they better start restructuring how they do their economy. And the answer is they've been unwilling to take that step because the people have been used to getting certain things for free. And then you move to fuel. And you say, well, my goodness, they should have much more fuel, and they should, but they have a really corrupt system and an antiquated system. And then they subsidize fuel. Well, everyone knows what happens when you subsidize fuel. If I say, look, I'm only going to charge you, I think it's 60 cents a liter, and in every other state around them, it's five times that price. What do people do? They try to take the trucks with the subsidized fuel, drive across, and make five times as much money. So it's asking for corruption. So when I look at this, and I think many of our advisors would say the same thing, your heart goes out for the poor Iraqi who isn't getting a fair share from his government. And then you listen to the government people, and you understand how enormous the problem is. So I'd be very careful about saying, you know, there have been great improvements. There have been improvements, but Iraq has a long way to go before it has a good economic system. The good news for Iraq is the trajectory is in that direction because they have those petrol dollars. And they do have a sense of sharing. So if you were to ask me this question 10 years from now, I believe the odds are that things would have improved dramatically, but they have not yet done so.
We'll take more phone calls in just one moment. Our guest this hour is Bing West. His book, number 12 now on the New York Times bestseller list, is The Strongest Tribe, War, Politics, and the Endgame in Iraq. He is a Marine combat veteran, served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration, and this book is based on 14 extended field trips over 6 years. He also has been spent time writing about and thinking about and examining counterinsurgency in Northern Ireland. I'm particularly interested in asking him about that, and also in Vietnam, where he served. More phone calls momentarily, 800-486-8655, our number, or email at talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to your phone calls now, and let's go to Mary from Wood County. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I agree with it that our, you know, our soldiers and are on the whole good people. I mean, my son's done 2 tours of duty there. Of course, he was in the Army, and he was in the hospital, and he was a medic, and he was trying to keep both Iraqis and soldiers alive. But this guy seems to just blithely skip over the fact that it was an unjust war. And if you think we aren't going to be paying for that probably for the rest of this century in our dealings with Islamic countries, you know, I'm not sure the word's optimist. There's probably something stronger.
Well, Mary, I'm glad that your son did serve his country, and therefore I know that you in your family have inculcated a spirit of patriotism and a belief in your country. I'm sure you don't want your son fighting twice in an unjust war. But I'm really puzzled by why the war is unjust. Saddam Hussein was a butcher. We went in there in the context of 9/11, where 3,000 Americans were killed, and Saddam Hussein had chemical weapons and was trying to get other kinds of weapons of mass destruction. We discovered that that was a bluff, and it was designed to keep Iran wondering when he was going to use such weapons against them. But by bluffing Iran, he bluffed the rest of the world and caused the United States and France and Germany and everybody else in the United Nations to believe that this man would hand those kinds of weapons over to terrorists to kill Americans. And so the justification for getting rid of Saddam, I think, is very, very strong. And I think if you went to 99 out of 100 Iraqis and said, is this a just war? They'd say, absolutely. So I don't see that we have any reason to apologize for having overthrown Saddam. We made a lot of mistakes in the war, but our cause was noble. Our cause wasn't that we were out to conquer anybody. We freed a people, and I think we should take credit for what we did.
What about the intelligence that was used that turned out to be not very true? Is that troubling to you, Bing?
You know, maybe it's because as an assistant secretary, I watched all these things. And whenever you're dealing with a closed society, I'll give you Iran, I'll give you North Korea. If they want to shut you out, they can shut you out. A classic example we're working with right now is both Korea and Iran. We probably don't have any better information about those two nuclear programs than we did about Saddam's. So, and Iran keeps saying they're not doing it. The rest of the world now is saying, yes, you're doing it. Now, there's another example. Supposing in the end we found Iran wasn't doing it. You see what I mean? If a society really wants to prevent you from knowing, as an outsider, they can prevent you. So we're always going to have some intelligence failures, both because of human nature, but also because of the nature of trying to spy on another country, especially if that country doesn't want you spying on them.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit, before we go back to phone calls, I'm particularly interested in Northern Ireland, having just returned from there. I'm interested in the counterinsurgency studies that you did of Northern Ireland and also Vietnam and relating it to Iraq.
The basic point that I would try to make to anybody is, look, in counterinsurgency, what you're saying is there are insurgents among the people. No one's wearing a uniform. We, consider this now, though, we as Americans, foreigners, will go and live among the people. And if we protect them, then the people will gradually inform on who the insurgents are. Well, no, they won't, when you consider that as the model, because the issue becomes, what do those people believe? And in Northern Ireland, for instance, the British were an occupying force, and they bragged a little bit too much about what they were doing without really thinking what they really were doing, and they didn't really change things until the politics changed. In Iraq, we would still be the occupiers, disliked or hated, if the Sunnis at some point hadn't looked at al-Qaeda and said, whoa, wait a minute, we're on the wrong side of this. And this, I spoke to Sheikh Sattar, who in my judgment was the bravest and the finest Iraqi leader I ever saw, and he began this movement of the called the Awakening Movement of the Sunnis. And I asked him, I said, Sattar, couldn't we have done that 3 years earlier and saved ourselves all this grief on both sides? And he thought about that for a minute, and then he said to me, no. He said, you Americans couldn't persuade us. We Sunnis had to convince ourselves. So what I take away from all the counterinsurgencies that I've watched is the population has to convince itself that it wants a change.
Thanks, Mary, very much for your call.
Thank you, Mary.
And we go next to Lori from Milwaukee. Hi, Lori.
Yes, hi. I have two questions, and I will take my answers off the air. First of all, what about the news reports that Shiite government is rounding up the sons of Iraq, the Sunnis, and jailing them or killing them? That's been in the news recently. And secondly, everybody keeps saying, we'll leave victoriously. What is victory?
Thanks for your call.
Lori, first, the Shiites rounding up the sons of Iraq, which is these Sunni neighborhoods. This is, as I said, what our military is dealing with every day with the Shiite government, especially with Maliki. And the Shiite government and Maliki say, look, we are arresting some of them because we know that they fought against us. And in essence, what the Americans are saying is, hey, if we can let bygones be bygones, can't you let bygones be bygones? And Maliki and his government are coming back and saying to us, you don't know those Sunnis the way we know them, and it's our sovereign nation. So this whole thing is a bargaining back and forth. It's not massive. Nothing is happening out there on a massive scale. These are ones and twos that get reported in the newspaper. I've known some of these guys. And you go and you argue like mad with the Iraqi government and say, don't do this. I look at it as two steps forward, one step back. I think you gradually get there. But you're right about it, Lori, but it's not on a massive scale.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the definition of victory to me is we get out and leave behind a country that is stable enough that it can look after its own security. And you might say, my goodness, that's the most minimum definition I've ever heard. Well, yes, it is, but it's better than defeat, it's better than chaos. And the one thing that did happen that I think we're not going to realize the results of for about another 2 years is that al-Qaeda was thrown out by the Sunni people, and al-Qaeda had come there saying, we are coming to liberate you. And now the Sunnis in Iraq hate al-Qaeda, and I think that's going to affect how al-Qaeda is seen throughout the Middle East over the next several years.
How much faith do you have in Maliki, Bing?
Wow. complex. Sometimes he's overconfident. Sometimes he's very secretive. You can see part of him resents that Americans had to do this rather than he being able to do it. On the other hand, you can see that he wants to be known as the man who unified Iraq, but he doesn't have a strong power base, and he's dealing with everybody pulling him a lot of different directions, I think.
But before that, he achieved fame in the late 50s and 60s for writing a book called Language and Thought in Action, which was an unlikely runaway bestseller, which pushed a fairly eccentric theory of language called general semantics by a guy named Korzybski, according to which that thought is strongly determined by language. It's a strong version of the linguistic determinism hypothesis, and that you could change people's thinking patterns for the better by language reform. So, for example, if according to one policy suggestion, if we attached a subscript to everyone's name, so we talked about John 1954 and John 1972 and John 1998 and so on, instead of just John, then that would shake us out of the prejudice of thinking that it's the same person who persists over time, whereas in reality we're always changing, and it's not fair to punish someone in 2008 for something they did in 1964 because they were a different person at the time, and it's only because we use the same word for them that we think of them as the same. Now, I think it's a kind of crazy theory. It's way too extreme, and I discuss in the book the relation between language and thought, and it's not nearly that cause and effect relationship that Hayakawa assumed. The Elements of Style by Strunk and White is a little style manual. It's been assigned to students for decades and decades, and I send students to it. I think it's got a tremendous amount of good advice as to how to compose stylish and easy-to-read prose. And I talk a little bit about style in the Stuff of Thought, but it's not a major theme of the book.
John, thanks for the call. Jimmy from Eau Claire, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, Jimmy, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. So I want to talk about the way that the meanings of some words bleed into its partner. I'm talking about, like, old coot, for example, and effete snob.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can call someone a coot, but a coot is just a bird. It can either be a young coot or an old coot.
Well, I think I don't know enough about the habits of coots to know what it is about the coot that reminded someone of curmudgeonly senior citizen. But whether coots are irritable and short tempered, or what the connection was, but there are of course many derogatory terms for people that come from animals, often from either some emotional reaction that we have to the animal, a snake, a shark, a rat, a pig, or from some characteristic behavior of the animal, as we discussed earlier with meaning the verb to goose. The other one was effete snob. Many people remember Spiro Agnew's denunciation of the press as an effete corps of impudent snobs,
right,
which was kind of ironic because that's a rather effete and snobbish locution.
Yes.
I believe it was actually written by William Safire, who was a speechwriter for Agnew at the time. Yes, and it's been, and Safire, of course, has a marvelous way with words, but it's almost a self-refuting accusation.
And thanks so much for the call. Well, we're out of time. Stephen, thank you so much. We could have gone on and on. It was a great, fun hour. I appreciate your time. Stephen Pinker is the author of The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature. And he is a professor of psychology at Harvard University and has written several other books as well. That was fun, wasn't it? Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour, and thanks as well to John Treader for on-air production. His other books, he talks about this particular volume rounding out another trilogy, and maybe you've read some of these, three books on human nature, How the Mind Works, and also The Blank Slate, and now this book, The Stuff of Human Thought. So, a couple things to remind you of. I'm no longer here on Fridays, so I'll be with you again on Monday. Veronica Rickert will be here tomorrow from 9 to 11. Monday, Bob Schieffer will be with us, longtime Washington Bureau chief and anchor and interviewer for CBS News. He's written a book about his many years in the news business, and so he will be with us on Monday. We'll have our All Things Political on Monday, which we always do. And just a reminder, as we get closer to the time to vote for the presidency and other offices, we'll be taking our show on the road Thursday, October 30th, 9 to 11 a.m. at the Alumni Memorial Union Ballroom at Marquette University. A reception will follow. We'll have, well, we'd like to have presidential candidates, but we certainly will have political analysts and people from the major campaigns. And we'd like for you, in addition to Marquette students and faculty, to join us in the audience. You can do that by calling 414-227-2047 to sign up. Thanks for listening. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.